guys, welcome to Adrian Has Issues. I'm Adrian, and finally, I feel really good about this because all those awesome people I met at New York Comic Con, I'm now finally in a position to actually start talking to them, and it feels so good because I always feel bad when I meet people and they're really awesome. It's like, oh yeah, I do a podcast, and unfortunately their schedules don't pan out, or you know, people get the full idea to reboot their shows like right in the middle of the run. But actually, our today's guest is a illustrator, designer, comic book artist, and also just an overall badass dude. Well, we'll get into how we ended up meeting, but without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Frank Espinoza. Frank, how's it going, man?
Hey, Adrian, how's it going? Thank you so much for having me.
No, no problem. It's been awesome. And again, I know we had met, this is what, going back October of New York Comic Con?
Yes.
And
yes, definitely.
It's pretty funny because originally, and I don't say this to be mean, but where we met, we were kind of like in that small press area because you had a booth for your company, The Art of Frank Inc. And I think I was maybe at like the booth next to yours or maybe two down. And I feel bad for whoever I was talking to because halfway through that conversation, I immediately tuned out because I heard music and I'm like, that sounds like, but that can't be, but who knows of this band? I'm like, I had, and I literally, like, I felt bad because I feel like I deliberately cut the previous conversation short, slid over. I'm like, are you playing Bury Your Dead? And it was pretty awesome because in the whole time, like, we hadn't even gotten into your comics, so we spent a better half of, like, 15 minutes just talking music and talking about Bury Your Dead. For those who don't know, they're a hardcore band out of, what, Massachusetts, right? Out of New England?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah, so it was just like we kind of really started vibing on that. And then from there, you know, we went on to your comic book projects. And it was cool because I know one of the functions of having, you know, you guys, when you guys have booths at comic shows, you know, obviously you're there to promote your stuff. But it was cool that we kind of got to meet on that level.
Yes, definitely, definitely. God, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, it's cool. But I guess we should probably get into this, though. So your book, Regenesis.
Yes.
That was actually the book you had there. Do you mind maybe going into a little bit of what the book actually is about?
Sure, definitely. Basically, it is a graphic, adult, actually, graphic novel. It's the titles of, there's actually four books. Two have been published and two are in the works. But in the meantime, we just finished book two. And basically, the book is about a billionaire heiress that was murdered by her husband, brought back to life by a mysterious shaman, had her soul put into a body of a local stripper. And from there, in order to sustain life, she has to suck the souls of the evil. So she feeds off evil, and that's what keeps her, you know, regenerated. And so basically she's out for revenge, and it's a bloody, gruesome, sexy story told in four parts, and we just see where she goes, where either she becomes, either she gets justice or even worse, gets revenge. So we'll see how that turns out.
Right, because I did read... Wait, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm sorry. For some reason, you know what? Let me just do something on my end because I guess the audio had dropped out. What I'm going to do is I'm going to record this on a separate track so at least that way I have it. Mm-hmm. Hate having to jump in the middle. Okay, that's fine. All right, so yeah, I had actually bought book one and book two that day, and it's actually really cool, but I didn't realize how dark it was, because I think after I had met you, like the day after, I was waiting for a friend of mine to get into the city. So, of course, I'm catching up on all the books I had read prior. And I was like, you know, this is a really cool story. I'm like, holy shit, like this got really, it's a really intense book. And I noticed the one thing, though, it's really, I like how, you know, the story is told usually to like a visual medium, like, because I know a lot of times a lot of books, you know, they kind of get very bogged down with a lot of exposition, but a lot of the story unfolds, and in a way, you almost kind of don't know what's about to happen until it actually happens. But what is actually the inspiration behind this story? Like, where did you actually draw, like, you know?
Draw inspiration?
Yeah.
Well, definitely, thank you for the kind words. Basically, I basically the story's a, I forgot to mention it's based out of Las Vegas, and although I'm originally from New York, I visited Las Vegas a couple of the times with a company that I was working with. We were doing a trade show called the Consumer Electronics Show with the CES, which they usually give around in January for all the big tech shows. Anyway, it was my first time back in, let's see, it was 2008. And I stepped foot on Las Vegas, and I never saw anything like it. It was, I mean, even being from New York, you know, we're, you know, big city and whatnot. But when you hit the pavement over there, it's like even just the airport itself, it's just super decked out in casinos and slot machines and everything. But even just getting off the plane, I felt this, I don't know, like a smell in the air, like an evil vibe of the town, and I just felt like, wow, this place is charged with like a dark energy, and I need to tap into this. So, the more I got into the city, like we went to the mostly the big strip, and from then on, I ever even went to the casinos. I just like looking at things and even the people there. I just felt like, wow, this is like where, you know, when you see in Hollywood, you know, they portray like the, you know, scenes going on and whatnot. But I felt like when I was there, I was like, wow, I felt such evil everywhere. Not that I'm like a prude or anything, but yes, I was like, wow, this is really, I don't know, I just felt this dark energy. And I was like, you know what, I can imagine a story here. And previously to Regenesis, back in college, back in when I graduated in 2005, I was working on a on the book of, on a an illustrative adaptation of the Book of Revelations called, which I called Apocalon, which is basically the apocalypse and Babylon put together, Apocalon. So I made some character design pieces for the Book of Revelations. So, and I had one character, Babylon, and I was like, what, you can actually see this on my website, theotterfrank.com. I'll send the link later on to the actual page. But basically, when I created this character, Babylon, I was like, what is her story? And in the Book of Revelation, she's basically the whore of Babylon. And how do we get past that? Like, what's more to that? So then, and I have to say, you know what? I've got to come up with something to explain this, because it was one of my best that I created for that series. So I was like, you know what? And it just came to me when I was there in Vegas. I was like, this is it. This is the beginning of the end of the world. So so basically, Regenesis is also a catalyst to that series, Apocalypse, which will be, you know, much more in the future. But in the meantime, yeah, Regenesis is basically the start of the end, or the beginning of the end. So that's the beginning of Babylon, our character, and she's the main character of Regenesis. So yeah, so my inspiration was basically the town of Vegas, and
It's pretty nuts because there's definitely that apocalyptic bend to the book, which was interesting because even in the first couple of pages, there's even when you see this heiress, there's really nothing savory about the character. And it's really cool how that sort of ties in. So, but I actually didn't even know that, you know, the book really even had ties to, of course, you know, spirituality or, you know, religion in terms of Revelation. So I'm imagining, obviously, like a lot of your work is inspired by such, or is that too presumptuous to say?
Here and there, like well, definitely the Apocalypse series is based on religion, but it was a dark take on it. So when you see the series, you'll see like people are like, wow, this is how did you find that in the Bible, or how did you find that in Revelations and whatnot? But yeah, I just don't imagine, you know, the end to be so pretty. So yeah, so it's I am, you know, I'm me naturally, I'm a devout Roman Catholic, but at the same time, it's my artwork expresses other sides of me that I don't express quite often. So sometimes, yeah, the darkness that I feel in other things, or if I can tap into something, then I'll just express it in my artwork or whatnot. So yeah, so it's a good assumption, I would say.
Well, I'm actually kind of worried now because that's kind of interesting. Because I'm sure for those listening, I'm sure who probably believe that and probably understand exactly where you're coming from, and some maybe who don't understand that. But I mean, personally, I could definitely, you know, had that vibe. I mean, I've never been to Vegas necessarily, but something so strong, like, I mean, there's a reason why it's called Sin City. I mean, there's no
Yes,
secret about
exactly.
it. But that is absolutely fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
So, is there a release date for book two or book three? I mean, book three or book four?
Actually, I'm already working on the treatment with my writer. My writer's name is Leah Hagen. She's been with me in two other Comic Cons in 2011 and 2012, but unfortunately, she wasn't able to make it the for 2014. But she's like a tag team partner with me. Like, well, I created the story, but then she helped flesh it out with her great writing skills. She's such an awesome writer. So she and I will be touching base very soon. She's based out of San Francisco now. She was at one point here in New York, so she's in San Francisco, but we touch base, and we'll be working on a treatment for book three very soon. So I would say probably the end of 2015, beginning of 2016, approximately. But yeah, I've already got some like really good story ideas or the next chapter for book three. So therefore, we just gotta come together, make some final decisions, and then after that, we start production. Hopefully, by summer, I'll start, producing artwork for it, and then after that, we'll see. But most likely, end of the 2015.
Awesome. So your production company itself, Art of Frank, because just looking from the site, you have commercial work, you have character designs. What are some other projects that you've worked on recently?
At one point we did creative services. So let's say if you needed a logo designer or any graphic design or even small web interface, I was able to do that with the Art of Frank. But now I'm more concentrating on the publishing end of it. So Regenesis is my first graphic novel series. But afterwards, I would like to create more and go more in that direction. Although the creative services route, I've been able to sustain myself in the past, but. Now we're just trying to focus more on the publishing side. For current projects, sometimes I do freelance illustration as well. I also I'm also working on a tattoo design for actually someone that I met near Comic Con, based off one of my sketches. So they saw something in my sketch, and we were talking about that. So we're working on that. But other than that, I keep it mostly with Regenesis right now. And if something comes up, then I may be able to take it on. But I also have a full time job as well. But and also I'm a dad, so that's my full my my heart
Which
belongs to my little guy.
that's got to be intense though, because it's one thing to then just make a comic book and just release it, but obviously you have an entire company doing illustration and commercial work on top of already having a full-time job, and also you have a family. How do you even find the time for that? Because honestly, I thought just doing the podcast was was busy, but I mean, holy crap, you don't I'd imagine you don't sleep much.
that is true. But at the same time, I'm very thankful for like the number one best thing I have in my life is my wife and my son, and they're the most important thing. So no matter what, like although my business is very important, I always they put them first. So no matter what, like when I'm with my son and my wife, when I after work, I spend time with them until they both sleep, like around 9 o'clock, and then after, I work on emails, and then I stay up until maybe like 1 or 2, just working on this, and then I try to keep as much, a nice balance between also try to squeeze in the gym as well, try to keep my health as well. But sacrificing, I say sacrificing is probably one of the biggest things. I feel like I put family first, but then afterwards, there's like tons of movies and video games and things I would love to do in my free time, but unfortunately, I just have to pick. Think about it. I think of it this way. As much as I would love to catch that new movie or as much as I want to play that game, I think to myself, okay, I'm playing somebody else's hard work. I've got to put my hard work into my stuff so this way someone else can play it. And basically, it's unfortunate, but there's times where like even as a parent, I just cannot catch up with a lot of these movies that are coming out lately. So some people say, hey, have you saw this? No, I just saw Rango the other day. So
Well, you know what? Not gonna lie though, that was a pretty awesome movie. So I'm glad you actually saw it at all.
Oh yeah, it's great. And then it's funny sometimes even I catch an old movie on TV and say, "Hey, I just caught this movie from 1961. It's really cool." But it's whenever I have my family time, I also try to mix in the movie time. So sometimes we'll even catch something on network television. But in the end, I definitely keep the TV to an extreme minimum. I maybe just watch one show, and it's The Big Bang Theory. I love that show. So at least I'll catch the new episodes of that. But other than that, I definitely have to sacrifice and say, okay, no shows for now. Just I'd rather spend the whole if when the baby's asleep and just concentrate on Regenesis because itself, production of a comic book, doing the pencil slash ink, coloring, writing, and all of that, and editing, it takes about 6 months to almost a year.
Wow.
That's with the job and whatnot. Like if I had it full time, then maybe, if I was doing this full book one actually did full time. That took me about 3 to 6 months. So, and that was just concentrated. They almost like a 9 to 5 thing working on a book. But then now it's like I have to consolidate any free time that I have. I have to like put into either marketing Regenesis, working on Regenesis, or even some freelance work to pick up some income. But other than that, I just have to make sure to use my time as as wisely as possible, basically.
And that's
So
something
sacrifice.
that we, I probably should have touched on is the fact that, I mean, obviously you have your writer, you have a very small team working on this book because it's you, Aaliyah, and is there anybody else working on the book? Because I can't remember. There's another name that escapes me at the moment.
Oh, Mariola Espinoza, that's my wife.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, so she does the flat coloring. So I remember in book one and book two she did the flat colors, but I'm not sure in book three she'll contribute a little bit, but that was before the baby came along. So now if she has any free time, she may help me out here and there with the flats. But yeah, she was part of our she is part of our team, so she's more like now more of a consultant. And she'd be like, okay, all right, Frank, let's get back to work.
Hey, you know what? You sometimes you need that though. But again, that's something that is pretty remarkable because, you think about a big publisher, and obviously you have so many moving parts. There's so many people who are doing maybe lettering and inking and coloring. You have your publishers, but really, self-publishing, and I mean, I've talked to a few guys about this. Matter of fact, I'm a gentleman who I'll be having on in a couple episodes. He's also a self-publisher. You realize that you're really kind of taking on, it's a massive undertaking because, being a comic book fan, I don't think some people realize just how much work, and sometimes I don't even realize how much work actually goes into making a book. So while, it's nice to see, a major studio bring out a book like monthly. But, when you're a small crew, it takes that much more work and involvement. But not for nothing, that's pretty commendable because, again, I don't know how many people could really pull that much duty and then on top of everything else.
Yeah, thank you. And I and it's very thank you for noticing that as well, because it's like it is sometimes people say, oh, indies or self-published, they're like, it's hokey, or if it's like amateur. But it's really, think about it this way, it's like thankfully we're doing this, because if not, then you're only going to have, let's say, just the big super major companies. And it's great for the little guys out there just pushing their stuff out there, because think about it this way, it's like it's almost like they're the monopoly, and you don't want to just have, people tell you, oh, here, this is all you have to, you've got so much variety out there, and just having the independent publishers out there, doing their thing. It's and it's very, it helps just overall with everything, just especially the views on comics and whatnot. So it's great to have just such a great variety. So yeah, it's very difficult, but at the same time, it's worth it, because I feel like, then we've got such a great array of work out there.
But I guess at the same time too, it does spill into the fact that I guess having a fan base or generating a fan base, I mean, off bat, they're dedicated. But I imagine like as far as marketing goes, I don't know if maybe someone out there is listening who might be looking at getting into their own books. I mean, I guess is there any sort of strategy in terms of marketing or maybe even just self-publishing? I guess what would you say are like the steps one would need to take? I mean, you've already mentioned sacrifice, but I'm not sure if you have any other sort of little like tips or anything that might actually help somebody else.
In regards to marketing?
Yeah.
Okay, well, in regards to marketing, I think one of the best things is, number one, just getting it out there, and the first, publishing it. Getting, that's the hugest step. It's like I feel like once you get that one book done, and it itself, it's all the work has been done already. Now it's just talking about your finished piece, and it's a little bit easier, because then you're like, okay, I went through like 6 months to do this. I definitely can tell you all the stories and all that stuff. So it's easier to talk about once you created it. It's another thing when you plan and you say, oh yeah, I'm gonna do that big book one day. But once you get it done, and then you can, it's one of the greatest things just to market it, because then you like especially with, like we do is the comic book trailers. I usually just grab screenshots of the pages inside, and I time it to music. And then I release it as a kind of exactly like a little trailer. So once the work is done, then it speaks for itself. That's basically what I'm trying to say. So I think the best thing you can ever do is just produce something, whether it's quote unquote good or bad, no matter what quality it is, just getting it done. Then you have so much to talk about. Then it's easier to push this because it's done, and now it's of just getting it out there. It's almost like it's easier to have a trailer than it is a teaser, because sometimes you see these teasers out there and they have like they're trying to make something out of nothing, while a trailer is more like having something out of, well, something that's coming out soon. So I guess the biggest thing I could say, number one, is having it out there, and number two is believing in yourself, especially getting a booth out there at New York Comic Con, whether it's either Artist Alley or even small press. It's a lot of money, but think about it this way. You're putting yourself out there literally, and people pick up on that. And once they pick up on that, then you have something, to start conversations with. And then once you have that one person or two people who purchase your book, then you'll have that energy to like, wow, I've got enough of a little buzz to get me going for the next Comic-Con or next book too. And it just starts to snowball from there. So, yeah, I think the number one most important thing is just do it. I don't like to sound like Nike, but I mean, that's
Well, I was
the
gonna say, well, hopefully they are not listening, and well, I have like maybe a couple of singles in my wallet, so hopefully Nike will take those. So let's go back a little bit, I guess, into your past a little bit, because I'm always interested in terms of one of my favorite things about talking to people on the show is figuring out where their geek origins come from. So I guess let's go back to a young Frank Espinoza. So what was your first sort of exposure into comic book culture or even, geek culture, whatever you want to call it? Where does it start for you?
Wow, that's a great question, because I feel like, actually, it's funny. Like today, I was just trying to find something on TV and I couldn't find it. Oh, I'm on vacation today, so I was like, oh, what can I watch? And I couldn't find anything on network television. And I said, you know what? Let me go back to something I really love. Then I just put on Darkwing Duck. Out of nowhere, I just put it on YouTube, and I was trying to get my son to it, and he wasn't into it. So, basically, yeah, he's like, what? That's like, he's like only a year, but still, like, it's funny. Like, that makes me think, like, automatically when you told me the origins, like, how deep can I go? And I'm like, okay, Saturday morning cartoons. That's where it started, because I remember as a very young child, either the like 3 or 4 years old, where I can remember. I remember I was just so glued to television in regards to like cartoons, every cartoon that came out, especially the Disney Afternoon back in the days, and especially just the Saturday morning lineup. I remember just ever back then there was no YouTube, there was no online downloads where if you missed a show, you missed a show.
And
And
it was
me,
heartbreaking.
yes,
There was nothing
exactly.
more crushing than either waking up late or having to do something and not watching your cartoons because you knew on Monday everybody was going to be talking about it and you didn't want to be that one kid
Like,
that
what?
missed it.
Like, missing all the references and whatnot. So it was one of those things like that Saturday, either I remember there was some hardcore cartoons that came out at 6. Like,
Oh,
I remember
yeah.
like some cartoons that were like, I remember Darkstalkers used to come
Okay,
out
oh
at
my
6.
God, you remember Darkstalkers? How great was this cartoon?
I remember like either like not Street Fighter, but definitely Darkstalkers. Or like my friend of mine said, oh, it comes out like around 6 or like 6:30 or 7 o'clock, like really early before all the cartoons came out. So from then on, all the way until like what? Noon until like Saved by the Bell came on.
Yeah, which is around like what, 12, 1 o'clock?
Yeah.
Because then, like on some channels, I think it was like CBS, you'd get like those weird shows that weren't quite cartoons, but they weren't like adult programs. Like there was like Beakman's World or like The
Yes.
Amazing Live Sea Monkeys and like weird shit like that. Like it's just
Exactly. So it was like that whole Saturday morning was dedicated to that. And I remember it was like from then on, like I knew I was like I love cartoons, and even after school, I remember when the Disney Afternoon, I was always on it watching it. And then I remember, so into comics now, into getting into comics, I remember it was the X-Men animated series on Fox when that came on. I just got into like Spider-Man on my own, but then I was like, oh wow, and it's just Marvel Universe, and I was like, and I collected the Marvel Universe Series 3 trading cards, And
I
then
remember
from,
those.
yes. And I remember I always wanted to get the holograms, but then I just learned from the characters in the back of the cars and their power ratings. So I collected them with my friends, and it just grew from there. And I said, oh, you know what? I want to learn more about them. And I went to the comic book store, and I played either I would actually play the actual video games and the arcades there, or the I would pick up some of the books. And I remember a big story arc when I was little was Maximum Carnage with the Amazing Spider-Man series.
Yep.
So I remember that was one of my biggest arcs, and then after that, I just started reading books and getting into it, and yeah, to the part where like that's it, my life changed from then on. I was completely geeked out and just grew and evolved from that. And then I remember, what was it? I went around second or third grade when I said, you know what? Let me pick up a pencil, and I wouldn't trace because it was frowned upon, but I would look at a book and then draw from that, or I would close. Saturday morning cartoons led into, let's say the Fox animated series and the comic books, and then, and then from then on and then on. So I would say definitely Saturday morning cartoons. And it's a shame now. I just read an article that there's no Saturday morning cartoons anymore.
Yeah, this was fairly recently, and it was pretty heartbreaking because I always felt like, in a way, like I understand, the way things are. Obviously, they want to push more educational programming, which I get. But I mean, to completely get rid of Saturday morning cartoons, especially since, it was an institution, and B, I mean, that really is instrumental. I mean, as much as the educational stuff. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are some like pretty awful Saturday morning cartoons. It's just, I mean, whoever came up with Cadillacs and Dinosaurs, well, I don't try to like crap on their art. It's just like, okay, this is clearly focus tested.
Yeah, and some of them just I remember what creepy crawlers. I remember that was like that was it this thing where you used to create your insects in this like it was I think the male version of
The Easy
like
Bake
Easy Bake
Oven?
Oven. Yeah. Exactly. And I was like that I remember as a kid I sniffed it out. I was like, oh man, this is basically you're making a cartoon out of a toy. The only exception is Mighty Max. I remember Mighty Max, I did not like the toy. I thought it was a terrible toy, but the show was mind-blowing. That was an intense show.
It really was. That was almost a little too much for me. And I don't know if you've ever played the video game for that.
The Super Nintendo version?
I played the Sega Genesis version myself.
I have it. I own it.
Oh God, how I first off, just from me to you, I am so sorry you had to go through that in your childhood. Because
Oh.
that was the what that if I'm remembering correctly, that was a game where you had to like throw like boulders into like a portal or something weird.
Yes. And it barely had any ties in with the show. And I remember they had a little, the instruction booklet had like the last 5 pages. Oh, free comic book. But it was like, it was, the last 5 pages of the instruction booklet. And it was great. But then after that, I was like, I don't see much of the show in this. Yeah, it was just extremely boring. And I never beat it, and I never wanted to beat it. It's still in my collection. As in, I'm just hoping that maybe one day I can find a something online for cheats or whatnot to see what's the whole point of the game. But overall, I thought the show was amazing. I remember there was like some episode I still kept on VHS. But yeah, that was one of those things where like some cartoons were based off of toys that were completely commercials. They were like almost like 30-minute commercials for these toys, and others were like little surprise hits, and that was one of the biggest surprise hits that I remember when I was a kid. Yeah.
I wonder if that holds up though, because I don't know if you had that issue where sometimes you'll go back and maybe on YouTube or something and rewatch maybe an episode of a cartoon you long since like you long loved, and looking back, and unfortunately you're kind of watching it through that filter of an adult going, wow, I don't remember, like, wow, I was into this.
Yeah, that's crazy. I remember as a kid, the animation looked amazing. It was mind-blowing. And now I'm an adult. I actually went to college for illustration, and I had a minor in animation. So I actually studied traditional cel animation.
Oh,
And
cool.
oh, sorry.
I said, oh, that's pretty cool.
Oh, thanks. So now looking back at those old cartoons, either the Saturday morning or even the weekly cartoons, I look back and I said, wow. That was not a lot of work. I remember I didn't like Street Sharks back then, but I remember even back then I didn't find it was great. But now I saw hundreds of flaws in it, and I'm like, oh my gosh, how did this get away? There was even like one scene where like the train was going on a track, and it wasn't on the track; it was just moving. And I remember it was in the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
Oh no, don't
Yeah.
break my heart, because I
So,
know you're gonna say something that's gonna crush my spirit, but please tell me.
no, it's a great show, but then I remember watching an episode, and there was one scene where Mario's face wasn't painted on the character, and I was like, whoa, that just flew? I mean, like, what was the quality control back then? I guess they were like cranking out so many cartoons, they were like, ah, no one's gonna notice a face is missing or something. So it was one of those things where, like, now when I'm looking back at it, I'm like, now I can see these flaws, and I'm like, gosh, I wish I was a kid again so I can like see right through it. But yeah, I mean, not see right through, like, fall for it. But now, like, I'm looking at things too analytical. Like, huh? How do they get that background pan to work? Oh, but some like today, I was watching the same Darkwing Duck episode, and I was like, wow, the animation is spot on, and it's still like 20 years later, and it still holds up pretty well. Like, that was Disney, of course, but
Right, because they usually kind of go all out even with their cartoons, but did you notice a lot of flaws with theirs just from like as far as animation? Or was it only like, because I noticed a lot of the shows that you mentioned that were kind of weird, those were a lot of shows that were like on the Fox Kids Club, so.
Yeah, it was weird. Oh, and even worse, some of them were, I think, Deke Entertainment, DIC Entertainment, and that would
Yep.
appear only on Channel 9. It was like, well, Mighty Max was one, which was acting. I felt like the animation was actually pretty good. But then Creepy Crawlers had crappy animation. Street Sharks had horrendous animation. There was a spin-off with dinosaurs. That one was, I forgot the name of that one, but that was also pretty bad. But yeah, this is my little 1-year-old in the background.
Hey.
Yeah. Oh, he just left. But
I was
yeah.
gonna say, oh great, Dad's talking about Street Sharks, let me go.
Yeah. No, he just no, it's funny. Like, he won't like, I can imagine, like, now at this age I'm looking at it, it's like, it's not that great. Imagine with him looking at it. It's like a lot of his cartoons now I've noticed are mostly 3D. And I notice that he notices that. Like, he picks up on 3D animation versus 2D. So it's like some certain things he's not gonna be like grab. Like, I showed him like old school Mickey Mouse with the cel animation.
Right.
He recognizes the characters, but he's not too into it. But then the Clubhouse, which is completely 3D, he's stuck on that. He'll stare at that for hours. So it's interesting how, like, even he's so young, but like the new generation, it's almost like it's the standard now. 3D is a cool thing and whatnot, but like us dinosaurs, I guess, like we're more into like
Yeah,
just
we were
the
kind of like one of those last generations, I feel, that kind of had that transition from, hand-drawn cel animation to 3D. And of course, unfortunately, now I feel like how my parents probably felt when they first saw like Toy Story, where it's like, this is the animation we used to have back in the day, back in the good stuff. And you look back, I'm like, oh man, how I don't know if I could defend this as heavily, because it's like, but I guess everything has a like a time and a place. But I guess there's still, of course, you being who you are, you'll probably still at least show your son, the history of and saying, hey, while he may not necessarily hold the same affinity for it that you do since you grew up with it, but it's at least now he can at least see, what came before. So that's actually pretty awesome.
Oh yes, definitely. I have to give him, once he gets a little older, we'll go through like the Disney classics, or even yeah, I'd love to show him some of the Fox animation, not Fox, the X-Men animation, and certain
Which.
things. Like, I'm sorry.
Like I said, looking back, like the X-Men animation was surprisingly, like, it still holds up.
Yeah. And it was very faithful to the material too, which was surprising, because I mean, not that it was like too mature per se, but even as a kid, I was thinking to myself, I mean, it stuck with me as a kid. I remember the plot lines and whatnot, but I'm surprised that they would that this is meant for very young children, like, 7 or 8 and whatnot, and they gave us, it felt like they weren't talking down to me. It felt like, okay, this is exactly what they were, doing in the comics here, like, especially Days of Future Past. I saw that as a, it was both a com it was based off of the comic. It was so, it was pretty much close to faithful to the material. So I was surprised that they even went that far and they would explain certain things and even the themes of it. Like you could tell it was especially it was about mutants and whatnot, but it felt you could sense like it was about like almost like the stuff that was going on back in the civil rights movement. You felt that as a kid. So I was felt feeling like a little bit of a it was almost educational in that sense too. Like you didn't have to use like race, you just using the like mutants and whatnot. We saw that comparison, so it was very deep, especially for quote unquote a kid show. So I was glad that we got such great content back then, where I felt like nowadays people are it's censoring too much to the point where I'm like, wow, I'm glad that the ratings back then, PG-13 and R, were a lot looser than they are now. Now they're a little bit so tight where like I'm like, whoa, we especially remember the Ninja Turtles, the first movie.
Yep, I was watching that a couple of weekends ago. It's one of my favorites of all time.
And it felt like now that I'm looking back at it, it felt like maybe a young Christopher Nolan directed it because it had such a dark tone to it.
It really did. And I guess maybe because there wasn't a lot of, blood and profanity. Like, it was. Because I don't remember the original rating for that. Was that PG-13 or was it PG?
To me, it blurs the line. What makes it a little bit PG-13 was the fact that Raphael screamed, "Damn!" And
Multiple times in that movie. I think he actually was the one that made me curse.
and they actually used their weapons, and it was like some action and fighting in it. And then afterwards, I read up on it that a lot of the parents were like, "Okay, you know what? Let's tone it down for part two." And part two was very already a little bit lighter, and then part three, oof, all right, forget about part three, but.
Oof, I almost tempted. I was actually joking with a friend of mine on our last episode that I was gonna sit down and rewatch three and try to do like a podcast reviewing it. And I realized I don't think I could do it because I think maybe about 20 minutes into it, I just immediately check out.
Oh yeah. I don't know. I have it, and I actually it's so funny. I have parts 1, 2, 3, and TMNT, the 3D animation they did. I literally went part one, part two, skip part three, and went straight to TMNT. And I was thinking to myself, wow, I don't know why I just don't want to go to that. And I'll have the courage to go back because see I even saw the last time I saw part three was in the movie theater when I didn't know about it, and I went to see it with my mom. And I don't know why it just stuck to me that I can wait. It's okay. I'm not that dying to see it. I feel bad. I love Ninja Turtles. Nothing wrong against them. And I wasn't too thrilled about TMNT, the quote unquote part four, but it was all right. It felt
Part
like.
four had a really good, the subplot I thought was fantastic. Like the actual storyline with the guy who's immortal with the statues of his siblings. All right, that's kind of cheesy, but I really did like that underlying storyline where that rivalry between Raphael and Leonardo kind of really came to a head.
Oh wow, that was intense, and I was like, wow, that I wish they would have filmed that where I would have seen quote unquote my guys in rubber suits. But like my friend was like, oh, you like those guys in rubber suits because he actually liked the TM and the new Ninja Turtles, the Michael Bay produced ones. And I'm like, I don't know. To me, the great things about the Jim company is the fact that it's they're guys in quote unquote rubber suits, but the thing about it, it's CGI. There's nothing there. While the rubber suits, it's actually a physical person and it's a physical thing, and you get to gravitate towards that a little bit more. Like I just love the fact that their eyeballs blinked and there's mouths move, and it just fit to me. It felt real,
There's
whether
definitely a
you know
certain
not.
artistry to that.
And even like Imatoka and Razor, yet now I see that they're completely animatronic, but still it was just the detail work behind it and the and there's all that work that went through it, just people, the time that to go through that was just impressive, even to me now looking back at that. And I just something that CGI just can't do to that. Like I think that's one of the reasons why I think The Dark Knight did so well is the fact that I mean there was very little CGI to that, but still it was like it's great acting, and you have your characters. It was like Joker and Batman. It was just you have their costumes. There's no CGI to that. It's just amazing acting, and then just great costume work as well. So it just felt like that was like true drama right there, as opposed to having such glitz and glamour of CGI. Although CGI, there's certain things that they do remarkably well. Like I don't think they can pull off another Hulk like they did with the Avengers. Like I remember, I love my Lou Ferrigno Hulk, but that I'm very thankful. Yeah, but other than that, Yeah, no more bodybuilders or green bodybuilders with little wigs on. I prefer that. Okay, let's keep it with CGI, but there's certain things that I feel like just some certain sense of realism is still preferred and whatnot. So yeah.
Definitely. Unfortunately, I feel like I don't. I tend to get very. I tend to toe a line because part of me almost doesn't want to. Because I always feel like I sort of start demonizing, CGI. But you're right. Something I guess does get lost. But again, I guess it's by exemplified by, let's say, someone like your son, whom I guess never had that connection to it because they're seeing it from 3D. I guess it's. It's less of a right or wrong, and I guess it's just more of a, cultural thing of like what you're used to. Because I mean, I look back and look at, things that my parents grew up with, and obviously I try to get an appreciation for it because I have to look at it through their eyes and say, obviously when they were growing up, this was considered, state of the art. But then even then, you could still see how amazing things were. Like even watching, like let's say the Ray Harryhausen movies, like Seven Voyages of Sinbad and Jason the Argonauts. With like a lot of stop motion animation, and you're saying to yourself, I mean, they look so primitive, but then back then you realize to have to animate, a figure frame by frame, especially at that time where, cinema was such a, was such a new thing. Like, I can only imagine how mind-blowing that must have been seeing it for the first time.
Yeah, I totally agree. Actually, they were giving Jason and the Argonauts the other day, and I caught some of that too. And yeah, it's one of those things where like, yeah, we went through that too with Terminator 1. That was a drastic change from Terminator 1 to Terminator 2.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, but if it wasn't for Terminator 1 and that like choppy robot, or was it T-800? I think. Yeah, the T-800.
Yeah, Z800.
Yeah, that it was choppy and like it's even screamed a little like that, like little pterodactyl scream there. But when it got crushed, I remember. But even then, like had it not been for that, it wouldn't have spawned. Just the idea, it's just the idea and the overall concept of time travel and the Terminator for that first movie. Had we not had that, we wouldn't have T2 with the liquid metal and then T3 with the it was a forgot the name for that one. It was a TX, I think. That was
I
her
think it
name.
was, yes, TX. I'm a little like I unfortunately I view the third Terminator in the same way I do the third Ninja Turtles movie, where it's like if I have to, I'll watch it, but I tend not to bring it up.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I don't. My trivia is a little loose on that.
Okay. All right. Well,
I mean, we could talk
this
about it. I just
even
don't remember
it's so
about
funny.
it.
T2. Yeah. TX was okay. I mean, T3 was not too bad. But the cool thing is, I felt all right. The just the fair was T1 to T2 because I feel like even like taking it to, even I remember T2 coming when that came out and just the liquid metal even the CG back then holds up pretty well today. And I just think had it not been for that, I mean, it was almost like you can't get higher than that. So like what else is cooler than a liquid metal robot or cybernetic form? And that's why T3 maybe wouldn't have didn't do so well per se, because like how could you top that? And they couldn't. It was almost like, hey, let's get something. It's almost like they went lateral. Like, okay, let's get another semi-liquid metal robot. Let's make her female this time. So it kind of it went lateral because they just couldn't never go past liquid metal. I mean, once you went liquid metal, how can you go any cooler than that, I guess, or
That's actually a really good point because that second movie, keep in mind, I was, I tell the story all the time. Of course, when we were little, my sister and I, we didn't have much in the way of babysitters. So, like, a lot of times my dad went to the movies, unless it was something that was so horrific that we couldn't see, we went with him. So here I am, what, 6, 7 years old? I don't know. I think I was like in first grade when I came out with Teen Terminator 2 for the first time. Scared the ever loving bejesus out of me. Like, it was one of the most terrifying movies ever, but yet I couldn't look away. Like, it's just amazing how much it captured a mood where you really felt like this was the end of the world. And the T-1000, whenever that thing popped up, it's horrific because this thing, obviously, it's not like, this living creature that has like thoughts or like, a conscience. It's all just logic based. So of course, seeing him running after somebody, and it's like just like that dead look in his eyes. I don't think it doesn't get any worse than that. Or like when it break through the glass and it turns to liquid metal just seeping through. I'm like, how in the world do you beat this thing?
And it's insane, yeah. And not only that, but it also can mimic. It can actually. I remember when he turned into when it turned into. I think it was a. John Connor's stepmother, and that scene where like he completely looked like her, even talked like her, but then like she had that that liquid metal spear next to the original. Like she
Yeah, that's
basically killed
right.
off, and I saw that scene. I was like, oh my gosh, like he can be anyone, anything, go through anything. The only thing I remember, his only limit is that he can only change to something his size. He can't change to something smaller or something bigger. So it was almost like, gosh, it was like your worst nightmare. It was almost like a sort of Freddy Krueger-esque thing there, where he can come at you. You don't have to be dreaming. He just comes at you anyway in any possible manner. So that was frightening. And how they, you know, I guess hopefully there's no spoilers per se. I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, but yeah, that was just a great challenge right there for any
I
writer.
was going to say,
How do
if
you
you haven't seen Terminator 2 and by this time, you know what? No offense, there's no hope for you, because, I mean, come on, that movie's everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, he sometimes you can see it on what was that movie channel? AMC, I think, or it was another channel that's been giving it. It makes it feel like it's a classic now, and it kind of is. I don't know. It was like what, 1990, 1991, around there.
Right.
And it's like, wow, 20. It's gonna get there to like 25 years old soon. So it's like, but it holds up very well. That CGI, it's almost like my friend and I. We're sometimes we look at 90s movies and like, oh my gosh, 90s CGI. You know, it looks bad.
I
You
mean,
know.
it does, but unfortunately, T2, like, it was the beginning of the decade, and it set the bar so high. It's like it took forever for anybody to match it.
Yeah, but still, like this day, it's like I guess they. It was one of those things where, like, you know, liquid metal, it's chrome, and just to make it reflect, it's impressive back then. But you couldn't really go wrong, too wrong with it, because it's almost like Toy Story. One of the reasons why Toy Story did so well as the first 3D animation for, say, for Pixar, Disney, was the fact that it's you know, they're toys, and toys are plastic, so the natural look of 3D back then was everything looked plastic. So it just fit very well. So it was one of those things where, like, 3D animation back then, I imagine, like, making something chrome or liquid metal, and then they used a video effect to make it just go in back into the human form. It just was seamless back then. That I still can't find any fault in it. I'll watch it again, and I love it. It's one of those movies. It's kind of like Shawshank Redemption, where, you no matter what point in the movie you watch it, you got to watch the whole thing now. Oh. I caught the movie. Oh, it's the tail end. Let me watch the whole thing. Like, you might as well, like.
Yeah, there's sometimes it's like I do that with like James Bond movies. I'm like, I've seen these things a million times. I own them on like eight different video formats, but if it's on TV like in a marathon, I'll sit there and watch them all. It's sad. It really is. So let's get back to you real quick, actually. In terms of, you're creating, do you have, because obviously, you being a writer and artist, do you have any sort of like creation rituals? Like, is there a certain mode that you have to get into in terms of whether it be listening to music? Do you obviously like close yourself off? So what is it like as far as the headspace you had to get in order to write or draw for that matter?
Okay, well, that's great questions. Thank you. I'd say if I'm working from home, if I'm like on a weekend, or if I'm, let's say, at night when I'm working, I have a weird ritual of not wearing, let's say I wear just my regular clothes. I wouldn't go into pajamas, because I feel like when I'm working, I have to think that I'm still like in a day of work. Like when you're at your job, you know, imagine trying to work in pajamas. You just won't be that productive, because you're like, okay, I'm ready to go to sleep with these pajamas. So I feel like, okay, you know, if even if let's say I start to, let's say today, I did some work earlier today, and although it's my day off, I you know, took a shower, like, and got dressed just like any other day. It's like a 9 o'clock thing, you know. There's like, if I was gonna go to work, I just treat it the same way, like, okay, this is, you know, time to be productive. So one of my rituals is just making sure I still feel like I'm, you know, in work mode, not, okay, let me work in my pajamas. No. It's time for pajamas, it's time for sleep. So I have that clear distinction between sleep and work. So that's one of the things. Another thing is, let's say, with regards to music, that's a great question, because I feel like music, as much as I love it, I definitely listen to it on my commute, but I feel like when it comes to writing, I can't listen to music. I'd have to have quiet, and also turn off my internet. I actually turn off my Wi-Fi, and I have my phone with me in case I do have to, you know, like, say, have an email or a phone call. But I turn my Wi-Fi off, and I just concentrate on writing. And in regards to, let's say, creating artwork, then I actually at New York Comic Con that I have a Cintiq monitor. So it's a monitor where you can basically draw. I keep that at like a say 45-degree angle, like if I were like a draftsman table, a drafting table. Keep that at an angle, and when I'm creating new artwork, I try not to listen to music. But let's say if I'm coloring, like doing some coloring flats for a comic,
Right.
then I can listen to
Right.
music just because it's kind of like one of those things. Like you're kind of like mopping the floor. It's kind of like one of those things. It's a rhythm you get. So I don't think so much about colors per se. But when I'm creating artwork, I try to keep. I'll pause music, and also the internet is another thing. I keep that off as well, because it's one of those things where like sometimes you feel like, you know, I need to. I'm gonna draw this car. You know what? Let me go and look up cars for this. Oh, cool. Let me check my Facebook. Oh, you know what? Cool. Oh, I like that. And then it just becomes like a downward spiral where you get to, you notice, oh crap, I spent an hour doing that. To try to avoid that, I just turn off my Wi-Fi. It's one of those things where it's almost like before I had the Photoshop and before I had the Cintiq monitor, it was just pen and paper. And so back then, when I would have pen and paper, is one of those things. Okay, I just lock myself in my room and I just drew without any music. It's one of those things where I just let my artwork come out of me sometimes. See, that's when, let's say, when I'm working on Regenesis or something that's focused on, well, let's say, in the deadline and whatnot. If I'm drawing out of fun, out of pure just I want to sketch and doodle, then maybe I'll pop in like an old CD, an older CD from, let's say, something from like the late 90s or some of the metalcore 2000s, and I'll draw. And sometimes I'll let the music direct what I'm going to draw, so I feel like, oh, I hear a lyric, oh cool, and I'll draw it out. So overall, my ritual is either if it's out of fun and love, put music on. When it's time to like get focused, turn off music, turn off Wi-Fi, and just focus on the artwork and take it from there until I start to fall asleep. I'm like, okay, it's like 1 or 2 o'clock. I try to cut it off because if I keep on going to 3 or 4, then it's easy to, do that, but then it's hard to wake up the next morning. So it's one of those things, okay, I've got my responsibility. So I've got to like find a way to limit that. So overall, it's just a matter of setting limits and boundaries to certain things. And I know certain rules. I just know I have to have the Wi-Fi off.
I really wish I had your restraint as far as that goes, because I unfortunately fall into that a lot. Just even if it's like, editing the podcast, of course I'm saying to myself, oh hey, I'll check to see what's going on here, or I'm looking up stuff, as far as editing, and then it's like, oh. And but then you of course, and I realize now why you do that, because originally it's like, why would you ever like shut yourself off like that? But then you'll start looking when you have a deadline. I don't know if you're anything like me, but you'll start finding dumb things to look up when you know for a fact that you have to work.
Yeah, it have. I'm not gonna say, oh yeah, it never happens. It definitely happens to me quite often. So that's why one of those things where, like, even it's a good thing. Sometimes I dedicate breaks when I go to. Okay, I say to myself, okay, if I'm gonna have a water break, I'm gonna go and have some water. Or I'll have like a little snack. I'll say, okay, now I'll check out my. I use my iPad to like go into things because I feel like then I go onto my couch and I look at the iPad. But I feel like if I do that on my workstation, then I feel like it's starting to blur the lines between work and play and whatnot. So I like the fact that it's like a dedicated screen to like I can't do any work on that. So it's just dedicated for like YouTube clips and all right, maybe checking stuff on it. But now it's my son's. He hijacked my iPad, so it's like one of those things where, like, I mean, he
So
doesn't.
you're not getting it back at this point.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, like, he's gonna use. My wife and him use it quite often, so it's one of those. Okay, so but I like to use it sometimes just to check on some new stuff, or if not, YouTube clips, or any little things like that. I use it for web surfing. But
Awesome.
yeah.
Which I'm actually really shocked about the music thing, only because I guess in a way I found that it's one of the few things, like I get, I guess the more, chaotic, I guess the music is, the more focused I get. But seeing as how that's kind of how we ended up really sort of bonding, what are you listening to these days? Anything got your attention, or are you just kind of just listening to whatever grabs your mind.
Let's see. That's a good question. You know what? Actually, I've been listening to the new Mastodon. The new Mastodon
Aren't
CD.
you the? I don't remember the last time. Wait, was there one after the Hunter?
Yes, it was the one after The Hunter. I think it's Once More Around the Sun. I believe that's the name of the title.
Wow, I don't even remember that even coming out. Is that bad? I'm
No,
just.
it's where actually it was nominated for Grammy. One of the songs were nominated for the Grammy. Of course, it didn't win, but
Yeah, I heard like Tenacious D won a Metal Grammy, which I kind of don't. No offense to, Jack Black and Kyle Glass, I just don't see how they're really considered metal against like someone like Mastodon.
yeah, you know what's the interesting thing is that that nomination was for a song, a tribute song that went on a tribute CD for Ronnie James Dio. So I've heard the song, and it had a mix of acoustic and some electric distortion on it. But yeah, it's one of those things, like it was based off a metal song, so I guess. And then the weird thing is that two other nominations on that two other bands were nominated. Also had so it was Jack Tenacious D, and I think it was Enter. I can't remember the second band, but it was another band that was also on that same compilation CD. So it's one of those things where, like, Metal Injection posted about that. They were like, "Wow, that shows how lazy they were." That they went, "Oh well, let's check on this other CD instead of checking an array of artists." They were like, "Oh, two CDs, two songs of this one CD should make it," and one of them did win. So I mean, no respect, disrespect to Jack Black. I think he's also, he's brilliant and he's absolutely very talented and whatnot. It's just it's one of those things where, like, the Metal Injection caught it. Like, they even mentioned it. Oh, we bet that it's gonna go to the most popular name on this list, and it just happens to be Tenacious D and whatnot. So, but
Yeah,
yeah,
it was a little heartbreaking.
but it's one of those things where, like, I'm used to it. It got to the point where, like, I completely boycott the Grammys, and I don't. I'll hear maybe something that happened on, like, online. See, not so much for the Grammys, but on the metal section, I'll just hear the best hard rock metal performance went to winner. Okay, boop, that's it. That's maybe 2 minutes of coverage that I need, and that's it. Because the rest of it's like, it's
But
just.
there's definitely a really bad representation in terms of like I guess, well, the Grammys always kind of get shafted as far as when it comes to like hard rock and especially metal, because I can understand why either I mean I don't agree with it, but I can understand why they wouldn't necessarily broadcast it. But it always just seems very odd the not necessarily the nominees, but I guess how they approach it, because it's like it always seems to not I shouldn't say always, but it has a tendency to go towards bands who you wouldn't normally classify as metal. Granted, I do think, I think Deftones won a Grammy 1 year. I think it was it for White Pony, which was pretty
Yes.
remarkable.
And it was
I
not
think
even
after that, no, definitely. I'm sorry, was that?
I'm sorry, it wasn't for like a single that they put out. It was like a song on that CD, which still was a really heavy song, but so I was like, huh, I guess it's just one of those weird things. I was thinking, oh, why are you gonna pick Change? But they didn't. They picked something else, but Change in the House of Flies. But no, I'm sorry, let me cut
Which
you off there.
awesome. I love how you did like you said the whole title. So you know what? I would shake your hand if you were actually in the same room because I love we had to make that distinction. It's like you had to say the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, because I was thinking, no, it was another song called Change, and I was like, but not from them, from some other artists. And I don't want to be confused. I was like, no, I have to say Change in the House of Flies, exactly. Yeah. So, well, thank you. I'll take that handshake. And I remember that's one of the reasons, one of the things we bonded so well at New York Comic Con. It was a natural conversation between you and I, and that's why I was so excited to do this, and I'm still am, and I'm so glad that I did because I'm having such a blast. So thank you so much for.
No problem. This is an absolute blast. And I guess it's funny because I love how now that I know what band you're into, we like occasionally we do spot checks because I can't remember the band you had actually sent me the YouTube link to. The one that Matt Brusoff and Barry did the guest vocals on, which was fantastic.
Yes, yeah, it was interesting because I can't remember the name of the band.
Hold on, I'm actually looking it up now because I have my phone on me.
Greg, I was about to say, yeah, I was gonna look it up right now too. I was thinking,
Hands of
like,
Mercy, there you go.
oh, I'm sorry.
Let's see, Hands of Mercy, Missing Link is. Whoa, hold on, that actually just almost started to play there. So, the rest of this podcast is going to be me blasting the song off of my phone.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so the way I found out was because I was just curious on like I'm just dying for a new Buried Dead CD so badly because I felt like they're pretty faithful on giving like doing the 2 year thing like most bands do like every 2 years they pull out a CD and they were one especially and I was surprised that it was from the Mike Terry Buried Dead which I also enjoyed 2009 to 2011 back to Matt Brusso and I was like wow they kept it was like okay lineup change I would give that a year more to add to like when out an album but they put it out in 2011 exactly 2 years from the Mike Terry and then Mike Terry was he actually put out back-to-back years it was 2008 where he put out the self-titled and then 2009 when he had It's Nothing Personal I believe.
Right, and you're definitely got one over me because I feel so bad because I know as people we shouldn't necessarily when things I am a little afraid of change, but something as kind of dedicated as Bury Your Dead was once that once Mike Terry came in and obviously the sound changed a little bit, I admit I was one of those people that shied away from the band because I felt like my feelings were a little hurt.
Well, I felt like well the way it happened, I remember it was 2007 where he announced the departure because he was going to go back to school to be a teacher. I was like, wow, okay, that's noble, that's commendable. So it wasn't like creative differences or whatnot. So it was like, okay, that was on good terms. And then they had, I think it was Michael Crafter, I believe he was from
The Devil Wears Prada, right?
Kill Your Prom,
Oh,
Kill
that's
the Prom Queen, I
right.
think. Yeah.
Yeah, that might okay, Michael Crafter, that's right. I killed the prom queen. I totally forgot
Yeah,
about
yeah,
that
yeah.
band.
Yeah, so it was one of those things like, okay, he stepped in for a little while. Okay, I liked him because he had that whole Matt Brusso like growl and roar and I was like, okay, great. I liked it. But then he got homesick and that he left, so that was kind of weird. So then Mike Terry stepped in and I liked Cassius. So when I heard him that he was going to take over, I was like, cool, I like this. And then I heard he redid one of the songs off of can't remember which CD he did redid it, but he did well. So I think when Barry the self-title came out, I was very curious of how it came how it was going to sound, and it sounded especially amazing with that title track. Was it can't remember the title track, not the title track per se, but like the big lead single off of that.
Oh, I can't remember, but I do agree though. The self-titled.
Sympathy. Symphony,
Oh, Sympathy Orchestra.
Symphony, I think. Let me just look that
Okay,
real
because
quick. But
I can't remember now. I'm so like, this is bad. Like, my memory must be slowly fading.
yeah, but I remember when that came, I was like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. I love the way it sounds, especially just the it sounded so like tragic, but at the same time it was so epic with the sound of like there was a point where like the guitar stopped and faded. Like boom,
It
boom.
almost kind of sounded like a droning engine in a way. It was really cool.
So the Sympathy Orchestra. So we both had parts of it, or I think you may have had the whole thing, but Sympathy Orchestra was a
I don't even know. Oh, okay, that was it.
yeah. And so I remember when that came on, I was like, oh my gosh, this sounds amazing. So then the rest of the album actually sounds very well. I like that album, and I know it had mixed reviews and whatnot, but what I liked was the fact that he kept a lot of Matt Brusso's style to the songs, right? They were dark and heavy, but this felt more, I think the dark, very super dark, but I felt the others were just heavy and aggressive. This was like dark, almost mood where it was like tragic almost. Like it's almost felt like almost like they mentioned, like an orchestra, like a symphony where it was like something dark. But then, actually, to be honest with you, Sympathy Orchestra, if I were to have a soundtrack for Regenesis, Sympathy Orchestra would probably be the song for Regenesis Book One. It just had that. I remember listening to Sympathy Orchestra and flying over to Vegas. I was like, wow, this is this is Regenesis. So I remember I give credit to that one song. It was such a powerful influence on Regenesis, even that song itself.
That's really cool. Like now, of course, now having once I reread it, having I guess read it, of course, with that in my mind, and of course, what I know, it does make a lot of sense now. That is actually really cool. I guess it was weird because he definitely had that Matt Brusso style, but then I guess he had these moments where I can't lie, he's got an amazing, singing voice, so you couldn't deny him. Because what was the one song? I can never remember the name of it. where I guess because there were a few of them where the choruses were just completely sung as opposed to going to metalcore breakdowns and.
Yeah, I felt like there was one, especially year one. That was the song with Mark Tremonti of Alter Bridge. He was doing, and Creed. He was the guy, he did the solo on it. He sings a chorus on that one where, I mean, well, Mark Tremonti does only the guitar solo, which is another thing. No, a guitar solo on a Buried Dead song. I was like, wow. So that was an, ex but it solo towards like the three-fourths of the song, but then I remember overall there was a sung chorus to that, and Dust to Dust I remember had also some singing to it, but then it's nothing personal, just nothing, but it was a lot of singing, some heavy stuff, but it was mostly, it became like almost a heavy alternative band.
Right, and I think at the time what sort of soured me a bit, but I think maybe the fan base as a whole, I think maybe weren't really too thrilled with that. Only because I never saw them live when Matt Brusso played. I saw them during Music as a Weapon. I forget which year was this. This was definitely around the time when the self-titled came out. So I would say, yeah, it was about 2008. So it was that summer. And you could definitely tell there was a bit of a disconnect, I guess, because it would break into one of the one of the classic tracks. Like they'd play like either they broke into like either Legend or Mission Impossible 2, which I guess we should probably preface in saying that Bury Your Dead has a tendency to, I guess, have a certain theme to their song titles. For those who may not know, because I love we just kind of got into it. We never really did do much of a background, but I know the one album. What the heck was the name of that album? I should know this. Cover Your Tracks. Like that one was all like all the song titles were named after Tom Cruise movies. So it was like, Losing It, All the Right Moves, stuff like that. And then, Beauty and the Breakdown, the album afterwards, it was all like I think what, Storybook
Yeah, like fairy tale.
title? Yeah, like fairy tales and storybooks, which I know for the Mike Terry era, they kind of distanced themselves from that. So when Matt Brusso came back, it was I think was it Kurt Vonnegut book titles?
Kurt Vonnegut, his book titles. It was a cool thing because I saw the theme. I didn't. I'm not too familiar with Kurt Vonnegut novels or his writings per se. So I had to look it up online. And when I looked it up, I was like, "Oh, that is so cool!" It's one of those things where like you wouldn't automatically do that within any other band. You wouldn't like, "Oh, well, there's got to be a theme here." And it almost makes you like a detective. You're like, "All right, I got to figure out." If you don't know it already, you have to figure out. So it's one of those things like that's what something that I look forward to any like a Matt Brusso song now is like if if they do another album, I feel like what's going to be the next theme? Like that's going to make you, it's almost like a consistent branding where that's a Bury Your Dead thing, the Matt
Oh,
Brusso like
definitely.
trademark. So it's fun now. Like I look forward to it. It's almost like it's kind of like a Stan Lee cameo or a post credit scene. Now you look for that. You have to. It's like a Marvel tradition that you have to. Everyone waits after the credits. Like, it's you can see the movie theater whenever you watch a Marvel movie. Everyone waits, do all their credits, and then boom, you get that little Easter egg or whatever you get at the post credit scene. And it's like it's a standard. And same with Bury Your Dead.
And I didn't realize that with the Beauty and the Breakdown, where the song titles, obviously it had, a fairy tale theme, but what I didn't realize it went even further than that, where the album's theme kind of used Beauty and the Beast, like throughout the album, as a means of telling the story about an abusive relationship. I forget, was it in a liner note? Somewhere I had read that, each, song, it's kind of like, I guess it's told from. I guess from both, the abuser's angle, from the victim, and I think it may be also like friends and bystanders, or like it was a pretty deep album for what was, a lot of people would just consider metalcore.
And I still don't classify them as that. I still see that hardcore influence. Like I hear it, quite often. But yeah, I do. I guess you could categorize them as metalcore, but I still don't see them as that. I see them as a little bit more like. I remember Wikipedia also at one point referenced them as nu metal. I was like,
Oh
yeah, no,
no.
definitely not
No
at all.
offense to nu metal, but no, that's not right.
No, and it was one of those things. Like, I guess they were trying to figure out. Oh, I remember even buying the Beauty and the Breakdown, or was no, it was a Cover Your Tracks. I remember sometimes you get a sticker on top of the packaging that said, "Oh, Sounds like this is Pantera and what was it? The other band I was hearing. It was Pantera and Deftones, and you'll love Buried Dance. Like, what? Deftones? No. Whoa. Who wrote this? I don't know. It was like maybe like Kaiser Magazine says, or
Yeah, I remember during which, oh man, you got to come back on because we got to get into this. Matter of fact, I might even have to split this up because I don't know, we might be running a little bit long, but I don't even care. But it was just so funny how, during I would say the early to mid 2000s, I don't know, was it the label that was doing it? Because there was always a sticker and it'd be like something really brutal. Like it would be something like cattle decapitation or cannibal corpse, and there'll always be a sticker on there, oh, for fans of Taking Back Sunday and Blink 182. And I'm like, wait, no, that's where are you getting this information from?
They probably, I don't know who, maybe it was like a, who knows? It's one of those like, I remember MP3.com had some like little weird meta tags in the bottom of certain MP3s that said, oh, they would, ties bands like Hatebreed, hey, this sounds like, I don't know, and they have like all these little meta tags in the bottom, like, no, that doesn't sound like that at all, or whatever. It's like it's kind of like almost Pandora could do that to you. Like if you let Pandora like, take you away and you keep on, if you don't say nothing, you don't, put thumbs down to any of the songs, you'll listen to something from like Pantera and it turns into salsa somehow. Like, what the hell? How did it get to that? Like,
Oh, that's not good.
yeah, it's one of those things where, like, I guess I left it on where maybe I put my headphones down and I forgot that the headphones were still on, and then like I looked at my windows and like salsa, and then I just looked back at the track, like, oh my gosh. And I see how it got into that somehow, but it was just so not random. It got to that somehow. I don't know how it mutated to salsa, but it eventually got there. But I'm like, maybe it went through an El Nino somehow, and then somehow, I don't know. It was one of those weird.
Right, because I guess El Nino, they're predominantly Hispanic, right? Where the entire band is.
Yeah.
So then I guess they didn't. I don't know if they were going by title, because I know a lot of the music, is definitely influenced by, the culture. So it's, a lot of percussion. So I guess maybe they're just like that one little tiny strand of connecting tissue, and it just branches off.
Yeah, so that's one of those things where like maybe a computer spotted out, hey, if you like, Celine Dion and Morbid Angel, then you'll love.
Oh, speaking of which, I forgot. A friend of mine had posted on their Facebook page. Someone had taken performers, like non-metal performers, and made T-shirts, but in a style of a lot of metal and extreme metal bands. So someone had it was Celine Dion, but it was like written in that stereotypical metal font.
Yes, and I remember that was actually I gravitated towards that one because it said "My Heart Will Go On" and it had like a flaming heart or something. But it was like, whoa, that title sounds metal enough. Like "My Heart Will Go On," like depending on where you use it, like
Right.
if Behemoth had an album, Behemoth, like the Polish metal band, if they excuse me, death metal, they had that as a title, "My Heart Will Go On." Like, what does that mean? You won't automatically think, that, sappy, Titanic song. You'll think, oh, I don't know, depending on which song that you know, this which band or which just attitude they have, like a certain theme or a certain title can go completely different.
Frank, thank you so much because this has been a lot of fun.
Oh, definitely, and I'm very honored that you've chosen for us to to podcast. And it's been a great time, and it's just natural and fun. So thank you so much. It was a huge pleasure.
No problem. Real quick though, before you go, anywhere where people can find you, like on Twitter, because I know you mentioned your website was theartoffrank.com. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. www.theartoffrank.com. And if you would like to, if you're interested in receiving Genesis Book 1 or Book 2 or even a T-shirt, you can go to our Etsy page. It's etsy.com/shop/TheArtOfFrank. That's where you can purchase our products and whatnot. But Twitter is definitely at The Art of Frank.
Awesome, Frank. Thank you so much. Well, that'll do it for another episode of Adrian Has Issues. I'm Adrian, and we will see you next issue.